Good evening, wherever you are. Thank you very much for joining us on 2024's first installment of Just Like the Movies. Now, some of us might have made resolutions. Some of us might be taking stock. I hope you all had a happy holiday season. But right now, we're going to talk about a movie that gets into all that, and that is John Cusack's kind of underrated masterpiece, High Fidelity. I don't know, masterpiece might be a little strong, but I remember this is a movie I connected very strongly with when I first started watching it in the late 90s, early 2000s. It also happened to be end of high school, beginning of college for me, and also for my ruggedly handsome and surprisingly durable co-host, Johnny. Johnny, how you doing today?
I was going to say, you have a new co-host, you didn't tell me. happy New Year to you, my friend. And it's, so we are on the precipice of being friends for almost 25 years now. And this is a movie, like, you and I always talk movies when we get a chance to talk or hanging out, but we really haven't riffed about this movie much in our past that I remember.
That's true. I mean, we used to talk about John Cusack a lot, and then, like, I was thinking about some little moments that we've had here and there that we might talk about or might be a little too inside baseball for a broader audience, but that, like, I was like, oh, this movie might have inspired those things, like the top five things, or like how sometimes I would just yell, what? Like, just kind of for comedic effect. I was like, oh, that was in this movie. But this is definitely kind of a departure from our usual catalog. I know, I don't think we've really done anything that could kind of be classified as a romantic comedy. And that's probably if you were going to put this in a genre, that'd probably be the closest one it would be in, even though it doesn't fall into all those conventional trappings of what you would call a rom-com, but I mean, some of the base elements are definitely there. I mean, you're more of a rom-com connoisseur than myself, so why don't you kind of qualify that?
Well, yeah, there are guilty pleasures of mine. I am a big fan of the John Cusack rom-com Serendipity, which starred Kate Beckinsale, who was my crush for a very long time. And I believe he mentions a book, Love in the Time of Cholera, in this, which is like the main MacGuffin of Serendipity. So I wonder if he like just brought that into that movie. But enough of the useless trivia on that. Yeah, I think this is definitely rom-com. It has more of an indie feel to it, even though it was I don't know where the money went, but it cost $30 million to make this movie.
I was kind of wondering the same thing. I think filming in Chicago was pretty expensive, and there was... I was reading some, there isn't a ton of trivia about this movie. Like, one of the things was that, you know, this movie was adapted from a novel written, I think I said Nick Hornsby, but it's Nick Hornby, he's a British author, and several of his novels have been adapted into Hollywood feature films. And this was one of them, but it was set in London originally. So they,
you gotta say it like Hornby.
Hornby.
Nicholas Hornby.
Of the Northumberland. Hornbys.
Originally, it was a novella that was converted into a full-length novel. And then Cusack's like, we're going to do it in Chicago, because I like Chicago, and we're going
to
do it.
Yeah, I mean, they changed the protagonist's name. They moved it to Chicago. I think that made it... I didn't read the novel because I just didn't, but I wanted to see if they talked about the same bands or not. I assume they did because it was popular music. It was more like broader popular music. But maybe, like, I know part of it was they moved it to Chicago because John Cusack and his writing team, this guy, Steve Pink, who helped him write Gross Point Blank a couple years before this came out, and then D.V. DeVincentis, they're all kind of from that area, and they have that knowledge of the music scene, so they kind of injected that to make it a little more authentic. And, like, one of the kind of praises I saw for this film from several critics was that it felt very relatable. These felt like real people in real settings. And I don't have really firsthand knowledge of this, but if you're from the Chicago area and you live there during that time, like you kind of had an idea about these people, like where they hung out and like some of the, like, I guess the one venue they go to where they meet Lisa Bonet's character, Marie LaSalle, was in, it was called Lounge Axe. And I guess the lady who owns that is the dude from Wilco's wife.
Whoa.
So yeah,
really
kind of wow. There's like hundreds of like crazy music trivia factoids like that. We're not going to get into all of them, but I thought like that was one that I just recalled off the top of my head, you know, trying.
It's this movie is it's funny because they're casting choices made for this movie, and I did read that they wrote Barry with Jack Black in mind, and he's all over the pages. Like, you just, when he's doing that dialogue, you're like, yeah, that's Jack Black. And really, it was sort of Jack Black before he blew up. We're talking before School of Rock and before everybody had heard of Tenacious D, even though they apparently played at the premiere.
And he turned this part down initially.
And it's funny because I saw that they were eyeing Artie Lang, who I like, but he's not that good of an actor. I really think he could have derailed the movie. Like, you see Artie Lang and you think of him in like Dirty Work or Beer League, and you're like, yeah, Artie's funny, but this movie needed decent performances. And then I look across at Dick, and you know, David Arquette was considered for that. He turned it down, and I even think he might have been a misfire in that role, though. He does play, he could easily have played in his around 30 years old, playing a quirky little indie rock fan. I get that. But I think they made the right choices there. I don't know how you feel about this. I think where this movie really misfired was the love interest. I thought Laura, and I texted you how to pronounce her name.
Yeah, dude.
Eben Yale.
I was just going to refer to her as the Danish girl, because as disrespectful as that sounds, it would have been more respectful than me trying to pronounce that fucking name.
Let's just have some fun. What would have been your best crack at her name?
Oh, God. This is terrible, because it's not like I've never, you know, seen Danish actors before. Like, Mads Mikkelsen is, like, Denmark's probably most famous. So, Viggo Mortensen, too, before him. But
For our audience, so Laura, the main love interest, the main driving force of the reason why he did everything he did in this movie, is played by an actress, and her name is spelled I-B-E-N, and last name H-J-E-J-L-E. So, Mike, I think how I would have tried to say it. Let me hear how you would have tried to say it.
I think I would have said Eben Hale or something. But I think I'm just cheating because you told me. Like, I don't know now. Like, I was completely fucking flummoxed. Like, my plan was, every time she came up, I was going to refer to her as the Danish chick or the Danish girl.
I think your pronunciation is better than I would have said Eben Hegegel.
Yeah, those... It was a soft J. Yogging. It's a soft J.
Lars Ulrich.
So you did not like the casting.
I did not. For one, as far as I understand it, she's not supposed to have any sort of an accent, and you can hear the accent bleeding through. It was actually, usually actors, we applaud them for doing such good American accents when they're not from here. I don't think that's the case here. I could be wrong. Maybe there's a backstory in her character I missed in watching the movie.
Well, what they did was that they liked her for the part, and they being the production team, and Stephen Frears is the director, who also directed John Cusack in The Grifters a few, like, 7 or 8 years before this came out.
Mm-hmm.
And they liked her for the part, but... They were talking, and they asked her if she could do an American accent, and she said, of course I can, because she wanted the part. And then they kind of realized she couldn't, and then they kind of just wrote into her backstory that she was Danish. Like, they have, like, at her dad's funeral, you could see the Danish flag up, and...
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I felt like she was a bit wooden. I don't think they really had that great of chemistry. Even though it was well-written, I don't think they delivered on it, and I'm not going to put that on Cusack, because... He has a pretty extensive resume of developing on-screen chemistry. That's just my opinion on it. The movie made $47 million. Again, they spent $30 million on it. Chicago's probably part of it. I'm not sure where the other money went, all those cameos perhaps that we'll get into. But you slap, like, even just a Sandra Bullock or somebody even, like, a little lower than that in here, and you're probably looking at a $100 million movie, which in 2000 is massively successful.
I kind of thought the same thing about the Danish chick in this part, because they really liked her in this. They had a really hard time casting this part and the Marie LaSalle part, which, from what I read. And... Mm-hmm.
But Lisa Bonet played that.
Spot on. Love that pronunciation. But from what I saw was that the Danish chick was in a German film that one of the producers saw, because they had a really hard time finding what they thought would be an appropriate actress for Laura. And the main reason was because the quote I read was that almost any actress they put in against the Rob Gordon character would seem like his mom. And that's not a crack about women, like, you know, the age disparity between actors and actresses in films. It has to do with the fact that the character is so immature that they had to find somebody who seemed kind of youthful. And I guess that she projected that kind of energy. Like, I kind of thought the same thing when I was rewatching it, that I was like, this is the one, huh? Like, after, you know, you dated Catherine Zeta-Jones in her fucking prime, which would have ruined just about any man forever, women for all eternity. And this is the one. Like, this is the one that fucked you up. But when I thought about it a little more, because one, I don't want to, like, I wanted to kind of go against type a little bit and not, you know, bash, you know, the whole, like, relationship dynamic, whatever. But the second thing I thought about was the way their relationship is portrayed in the movie is kind of the way that he's describing it as he's starting to realize how important it was to him. And it's not that it was important to him as an absolute measure. It's more, to me, it was more relative. It was the fact that, like, you know, he's in his late 20s, early 30s, maybe, at least in the way the movie is supposed to be portrayed. He's already been in a handful of serious relationships, and he's just kind of, like, tired of it. And then she kind of says the same thing. Like, she's tired of, like they're just tired of trying to find people and trying to make, like, so it's almost like their relationship is like, when he describes the relationship as like, it's like the highs weren't too high. I'm paraphrasing. The highs weren't too high. The lows weren't too low. It was just good. That, like, that's kind of what comes through on the screen. So, like, if there's not that crackle or that electricity or whatever that you think there might've been with a different actress, I almost think of it as like kind of a meta commentary on what, like, the status of their relationship turned out to be in the movie, and like why they ended up finding their way back to each other at the end.
That's well put. Yeah, I agree with that. There's definitely a driving force in this movie is sort of like this guy sort of having a little bit of an existential, you know, what does it all mean sort of thing. And they directly call it out by Charlie being Catherine Zeta-Jones' character, like wondering why Rob was coming back around. And that was the case.
Yeah. She just had some guy do that to her, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, right. And then you see him encountering others in his top five breakups and realizing that he was kind of the asshole without realizing it. So it's funny in that respect. But, you know, John Cusack always plays these type of characters. I don't know if I love the, you know, breaking the fourth wall narrator for the protagonist all the time. It works here because, you know, we sort of feel like we're there with him. And I like John Cusack. I think that's another thing about John Cusack is if you like him, then you'll usually like his movies. And if you don't like him, you probably won't watch him. Where you think about this movie in particular compared to some of the other movies he does that involve romance. And this one has a bit more of a realistic spin on it. Like you put, Mike, yeah, it is a rom-com, but it just has a more grounded sort of regular people feel. And I believe you alluded to him. A movie review, and I think it was Roger Ebert who had said that he felt like, I wanted to leave the theater because I felt like I can run into these people and have these experiences myself on the street, and I wanted that. And it's like, that's a really good point, because you look at Barry and you look at Dick and you're like, these aren't these stereotypical supporting characters. They're the dialogue they're saying just feels not like despecialized. It doesn't feel like every line was written with this perfect curation. A lot of it's throwaway, but it makes it feel like, what are, you know, like you, me, and our buddies just shooting this shit. We're never gonna like film that and be like, you guys have to watch this conversation we're having. It's so engaging, but we enjoy having that conversation because of the chemistry that we all have. And that's what's going on here in this movie. Like, when I think about this movie, even though it's about Rob and Laura, I feel like it's like the record store, and not to be cutesy about it, but how everything revolves around that, like a record. And I enjoy all the scenes that happen in the record store more than almost anything else in the movie.
Yeah, and from what I read, the shoot was relatively smooth, but they would get notes once in a while. Like, so I think somebody, one of the studio people, asked the director, like, do we really need so many scenes at the music store? And he's like, these are gold. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and, yeah, 100%. It's, you know, I mean, I don't like pretentious music people, and, you know, Barry obviously comes across that way, but where they endear us to Barry is that you realize he's just kind of like a loser. He's not like a pretentious guy who like comes from money or anything. Like Rob says, he's like, these guys just showed up one day and I just started paying them. And it's like, they just love music so much and their lives are so unfulfilled that they take it out on people who know less about music than they do. And I sort of like how those characters are written in that way.
One thing I wanted to mention when you brought up Artie Lang was I saw that. I'm glad you caught that because I wanted to bring that up because I know what an Artie Lang fan you are. I think one of the you just called out like, oh, he's a bad actor or not a great actor, but I think he's too apathetic for the part. Because like if,
oh, okay.
Because if, you know, you got Barry who really, really... Can you imagine Artie Lang trying to do that scene with the Stevie Wonder record?
Like, no.
I mean, maybe it would work, but I don't think... It seems like he would just be like... He's like... I don't, you know, like, dude, I can't do an Artie Lang approach, but it'd be like... He's like, do you even know your daughter? She doesn't even like that song. There's no way she likes that song. And he's just like... He's
chomping on a Marbred.
Yeah. Like, just $4,000 in his pocket, like...
He's got some like powdered donut on his lip. Yeah, but like with Artie, he'd probably like talk about like Rush or like band. Like they would probably have changed the character so that Artie could like talk about bands he actually likes or something. I don't know.
Like Deep Purple.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. What do you think about that? Because I'm saying the choices they made for the male supporting characters were the right choices, but the love interest was the wrong choice. And I didn't see any list of, you know, this is who else could have played Laura. So I can't, you know, it's sort of unfair of me to say, but what do you think about that? Do you agree with that or am I off the mark?
No, I mean, I think there's some, like, that was the first thing I thought when I was revisiting this movie, because I watched it a lot. I don't think either of us saw this in the theater, but I remember I watched this a lot when I was in college. And you know, you're doing the whole, like, relationship, like what does it all mean, post-mortem thing, and the movie like kind of really feeds into that whole thing. I actually think that the Laura part, I don't know if there could have been a right actress for it, because I think, you know, you mentioned the whole thing about the, you know, Todd and Barry being kind of losers. Dick and Barry, sorry. Todd Luiso is the name of the actor who plays Dick.
Yeah.
Who was in Dick. The Joe Pesci absolute extravaganza, Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, if anybody's seen that movie. But, no, but, like, all these guys, it's funny because you mentioned those guys being losers, and Rob is even kind of a loser. Like, he's got a failing record store, he's a college dropout, he kind of gets into his whole backstory. And it was, you know, he's still not really all that great of a guy. Like when they lay out the reasons why they broke up, and it was all information that was withheld from us. Because the beginning, yeah, it's like she just seems like she's being really cold, and she's just like, you know, you're the same person you used to be, and I'm not. And it's she kind of represents a possible leap for him into a new stage. Like, but he. Maybe he would have to change some little part of himself. Maybe he wouldn't. But it's just that even if he was running a record store that was like marginally, you know, barely treading water, and you know, I think she looked past all that even before all the stuff happened. Then I think all the stuff happened that they mentioned, like that he cheated on her, and you know, she ended up having an abortion because of it, and all that stuff, which is, you know, that's pretty heavy. But
yeah,
it's all, absolutely. But like you mentioned, it's all pretty real. Like it's more realistic. It's not like over the top grim, but I mean that sounds like a pretty realistic breakup story.
I agree with that. And we all have our bad breakup stories, you know, in varying degrees of seriousness and the pain we felt with them or the baggage that came with it and things that lingered, all that shit. And that does make the movie relatable. And I do think it's cool that they sort of made Rob not necessarily this sympathetic figure, and they keep peeling back layers of that onion to show us, like, yeah, you like Rob because he seems like a very relatable guy. But at the same time, you know, we find out that, you know, he's kind of fucked up quite a bit. And that I think that's okay though, because how many movies have we seen where all these characters just seem like so perfect? Like anytime Matthew McConaughey's in like a rom-com, he's just like this perfect, great guy who just like has bad luck with women, even though he's wealthy, incredibly good looking, has a great apartment, clean as a whistle. And it's just like, what the fuck are we doing? So then that's where John Cusack makes his money. He's like, I'll come in. I'm not the best looking guy. I'm a decent looking guy. I'm an everyman rom-com actor. That's my niche. And yeah, he played Lloyd Dobler in the 80s. And like, we got to see him as like sort of the teenager going through that. And now we see him as like a 30-year-old approaching those sorts of questions that, you know, you ask like, what am I doing wrong? Like what? And then he realizes, well, it's kind of my fault too. But I do like that we also see the craziness of his exes too. Because if this movie was just like, oh, I'm going through my top five worst breakups and like I'm so heartbroken, and then it's just him having been an asshole to all five of these women, it would have been like, why the fuck am I watching this? Yeah. But so then you see like the pretentiousness of Catherine Zeta-Jones as Charlie, which my favorite line in the fucking movie. First of all, you and I have talked about this before, and I talk about this all the time. It's one of my favorite bits I have. John Cusack just completely refusing to use an umbrella in anything he ever does.
Yeah, he was very wet in this movie and mud covered.
I mean, how many movies do we see him just in pouring rain? So he's standing outside her apartment, and he just goes, Charlie, you fucking bitch! Let's work it out.
Yeah, really sweet talking her. That was the that's what always cracked me up about that. I was like, it's like, yeah, man, that's gonna do the trick, you silver tongue devil.
Just such a good line. But then, like, you look at like all the different, like, because it almost felt like every girl he went through on that list was very different. And I think it's, you know, one probably for to keep the movie interesting, because like we're not going to show this breakup and then go to the next one and it's like the same girl or anything like that. He went through different phases of his life and he met different people through phases of his life, just like we do. And you see sort of like the college relationship, the mid-20s relationship and all that bullshit. But we also got to see like why it didn't work because of them too. So it's like, yeah, he was a dick. He messed up a lot. He was very immature, especially to that girl in college. But then also they had their own shit too. And I think that sort of makes the movie a bit easy to watch, but also likable from both perspectives, where you could watch it if you're in a relationship. Like, I could watch it with Kathleen. She hasn't seen it yet. She'd probably enjoy it because it's not one-sided. It's not like this is a screw men movie or this is a screw women movie. It's just like people are fucked up and relationships are fucking hard and people mess them up a lot.
Yeah.
And this movie paints it pretty well.
Yeah, sometimes it's tough to have those realizations that like sometimes you thought something was a certain way and then you revisit it a few years later and it's like, oh, wow, that wasn't. Or you ask somebody else and they finally have like enough time, as the statute of limitations has expired, and like and like somebody gives you their unvarnished truth and you're like, oh man, I guess that's kind of how it was. Because it's like,
or it's like, why did you fucking tell me that 9 years ago? Or
maybe they did and you just didn't hear them at the time. Like, oh, that happens all the time. Like, when people are in relationships, it's like, I mean, I think both of us have been on both sides of it. We're like, either you're in a relationship that's not so great, or like your friend is, and you try to talk to them about it, and there's just no talking to them. It's like, they just have to get to that place on their own.
Yeah.
Or they don't know all the details. Like that, one of the, I mean, I already mentioned it, so I don't want to dwell on it too long, but in this movie where, you know, he mentions that, like, the breakup happens, and then, like, you're kind of on his side, and then you hear her side of it, and it's like, oh, man.
And then his sister in real life, Joan Cusack, is sort of, like, the audience. Because it's like, are you okay? And then, like, 10 minutes later, when she gets the scoop from Laura, she goes in the store, and she's like, you fucking asshole!
Yeah, she does a live drop-in to do that, too.
That's when you know movies from the 90s or 2000. She didn't FaceTime him. She didn't text him.
She didn't even call on the landline. She just showed up.
She got on the rail, went down to the shop, opened the door, let the bell ring, and just unloaded it. And
you know that shop's not a great neighborhood either. Even back then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the other things about watching this movie that, you know, you're just surrounded by. I know, like, vinyl is kind of making a comeback and, like, people are trying to get back into it, but.
I just got, for Christmas, Master of Puppets on vinyl, and I'm really happy about it.
Oh, yeah? Is the sound that much better?
I haven't opened it yet.
Oh, okay.
I was just listening to it on Spotify before. No, but you know what I mean? Like, it's just the aesthetic of it. Like, it's my favorite album of all time. You know, I want to get the whole classic look from the old 80s Metallica. And I was excited to get it. And Kathleen had gotten it for me. But I am going to listen to it, though, because I do believe that my brother listens to a lot of records now. When we go over his house, like, he'll slap some on. And it does have a full sound. I don't know if it's better or not. I'm not going to sit here and say that. But I'm not gonna argue with people who probably know better than I do, you know.
Yeah, I don't really have the trained ear for that, but I know I didn't know if that was still kind of a thing or if that's that fad kind of faded out.
I don't know. I think a lot of analog and physical stuff is on the way back, and we're going down a rabbit hole here, but. You know, you see, like, Best Buy is, like, getting rid of all their physical movies and stuff. But then these streaming services and even places where you buy a digital copy of something, or if they go out, your copy that you spent $25 on is gone. A streaming service can just take a movie that you like, that even though you pay for that service, and say, that movie's gone. Like, there's something about the permanence of owning something, and all you need is a DVD player to plug in and play your shit. And also the caveat of, you know, the way they're censoring certain things now, and they delete scenes from things that are inappropriate now or what, you know, all that kind of shit. And you're like, oh, but not my 1994 copy of, you know, whatever. So I do think there is still the allure to physical media. I don't know what it was like in 2000, because you got to remember when High Fidelity came out, that was when Napster was like white hot. And that was probably a massive hit to CDs, cassettes, which were fading, let alone vinyl. I don't even know that anyone gave a shit about vinyl in 2000. So maybe it was a Chicago thing. I'm not really sure. I should have done more research, but 2000
was a wild time.
Yeah, I think
in the bigger cities, you're going to have, like, bigger music scenes, like, and yeah, that translates to more people being a little more, I guess, to use a word today's kids use, extra with their music, like, on vinyl. Like, they had that whole mini, I don't even know what you'd, because it's not even a subplot. It's like they had that one bit character where he just wanted that really obscure album. They just wouldn't sell it to him because they didn't like him.
Yeah.
That was the guy's only option. I should have said before, this isn't some half-assed digital rights podcast. We're supposed to be talking about High Fidelity, and we are. Because when I was watching this, it did make me miss record stores. Like, I remember I used to go to, like, there was a record store in my town, and there was one in the next town over, and, like, the one girl I went to school with, like, her family owned it. And you would go there and, like, hang out and, like, look at all the CDs and, you know, take one or two home. And
absolutely. There was this record store by my house where I grew up originally on Long Island. And I didn't realize how, I'm trying to think what the word is, but it's like, it was this complete dump, hole in the wall. But it's, like, famous for what it's culturally represented for some reason in the middle of West Babylon, New York. And it was called Looney Tunes. And apparently a ton of bands would go there to do their record signings. And, you know, it's almost like I was too young to realize that. So maybe if I was a little older and, like, some bands roll through, like, Typo Negative did a record signing there. And it just would, like, and I know a lot of our listeners are like, who gives a shit about Typo Negative? I fucking do. That's who. But a lot, it's a very popular place. But there is something about the record store. You're right. The social element to it, and, like, the pride of, like looking in your favorite section. Like, for me, if I was in the metal section and, like, looking at all the record covers, and because metal records always have cool artwork, and just talking to people, be like, oh, I saw that band playing blank. And, you know, we don't really have that anymore. And I do feel like people today are way more socially awkward than they used to be. And it's because we are very closed off now. You know, we do things all digitally. We don't leave home as often. And I think that hurts the human experience or whatever. Call me sentimental, but I do enjoy that. I do enjoy the conversation about stuff. You and I are doing a podcast about movies when you and I probably aren't going to learn anything off each other because we've known each other for so long. But we just love the conversation. We love doing it. And I think that is a reflection of personalities, but it's also ties into that experience of going to a record store and you know, expressing yourself, but also meeting other maybe perhaps like-minded people, or maybe someone who may be a potential love interest that will turn into an ex and wind up on a top five list. Now you don't have to say, we're obviously not going to say names. Do you have if you could do it, it's been a day. Could you do easily rifle off a top five breakup list for yourself?
I wouldn't do that.
I'm not saying actually do. I say, could you? Do you think you could do it?
No, I mean, there was just one that was really, really bad, and the rest of them just kind of like made sense in some way, whether or not I initiated it or they initiated it. It kind of made sense mm-hmm. to me. But then again, that's with the benefit of hindsight too. So maybe I'm being a little like callous about it. What about you?
I could probably do it. Yeah, because I really haven't had a ton of relationships, so it'd probably be relatively easy.
Yeah, it's just like you just take the five and just like put them in a different order. Like just like
I'm like, oh, I have four of them, so let me count one of them twice. but. I don't, and top five lists are hard. I know you joke about your bottom five movies, but that's another part of this movie that almost made me a little angry, was at how easily the characters were able to come up with their top fives on the spot for things. And I was like, I have to believe that this is scripted, which I know it is, because I can't imagine like us or a group of friends just being like, hey, what are your top five most morose songs from the 1970s? And then you're just like, bing, bang, boom, bomb. And you're like, got it.
It's also kind of a shorthand to show you how obsessive these guys are about music. Like, I thought I knew a lot of random stuff about music, but probably not as much as you or like other people in my life. But like, I know a lot of random bands and like random musical facts and stuff. But it's pretty narrow. Like, even when I was watching this, and they would bring up these bands, and I'm just like, I should know who that is, but I don't. Like, I don't know that song. I don't know who that is. Like I didn't know. Like, I know some people probably be like, oh, what the hell, man? But like, I didn't know Blonde on Blonde was a Bob Dylan album. Like, I had to look that up. Like, I didn't know that.
Even though we like these characters, I don't know those either, by the way. And like, watching this movie made me feel like I'm not a music fan. But like, I've been in plenty of situations like back in the day where, say, I was at a house party in my 20s or at the bar or something, and you know, people find out you like metal, and you're like, oh, what are your favorite metal bands? And I'm like, well, Metallica, Pantera, you know, Testament, Trivium. And they're like, oh, okay, so you're like, you like, you know, like mainstream stuff, you don't like, you know? And then they name like Dimmu Borgir out of, you know.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
they do the whole, like, black metal thing.
They rifle off, like, these Scandinavian black death metal bands that it's like, you're not metal enough unless you decapitate your lead singer type of band. And it's like, dude, I played in a band with a guy who, and it was a short-lived thing in, like, 2009 or whatever, and he was the drummer, who had a Slayer tattoo on his forearm. And we split up because he said I was playing too heavy. So I'm like, fuck you. You know, like, I don't want to hear about your shitty music just so you could try to be the piano of metal music. So when I hear people get pretentious over music, it really bothers me. It really drives me nuts. But for some reason, I like the characters in this movie.
Yeah, I think it's like some people have opinions. Like, I know we obviously have opinions about movies. That's part of the reason we're doing this. But like, sometimes like, you got to try to temper your opinions, or maybe not. I remember when I was in my late teens, most of my 20s, you know, it was like my opinion was like, it was just straight, no chaser, like just no finesse at all.
Yeah.
And like, the older I get, the more I realize it's like, hey, Maybe if somebody doesn't think Girl School by Britney Fox was a great song, maybe they're not an asshole. Like,
what?
Yeah, I was going to get into my whole tangent about ass metal, but I'm going to save that. Well, no, this is the perfect time to do it because, you know, we might not get this chance again for quite some time, talking about a movie where music and, you know, small talk and which
ass
develops.
Metal?
Yeah, dude. You okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I was
thinking about 2003, you just being like, you know what, guys? Maybe we shouldn't go to Vegas.
Yeah, maybe sometime. Maybe we should talk about it in the future, possibly doing a road trip to Vegas. I don't know, but
just mull it over.
But yeah, just you don't have to answer right now. You know, just think about it. I know you got stuff.
We'll circle back.
Look at your calendars. Yeah, we'll circle back. No, No, ass metal is like one of those things to me. It's like, I just did not realize, this is something I've just come into actually the last couple years. Like, I just did not realize how many just fucking weird hair metal bands there were in the 80s that had recording contracts. There's like so many of them.
It's, yeah.
Like if you have Sirius and you listen to like Hair Nation and you just see bands like, you know, not like the ones that everybody knows that did cuts on like on Hollywood soundtracks, like Dokken and shit like that. It's like Garrison and like Britney Fox and like Anvil and like fucking Bullet
Anvil,
Boys,
yeah,
and shit like that. Like, it's just, it's all like hair metal, but it's like more obscure. That's what I'm talking about, ass metal. That's kind of the term me and my one buddy in the lumber business kind of glossed, and we're just like, we're just upset. Like, it's like, and there's no bottom to it. Like, if it never ends. And then it's like, if you think about the indie music scene, it's got to be like worse than that exponentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is that whole like artiste element of it where you want to like be this, not, well, whether it's a fan or you're the musician yourself, just like you want to just seem like you're so well versed in the culture of the music and anything on the surface that sells a lot of copies isn't real art or whatever. And I think that's like, you know, the stuff like a Kurt Cobain struggled with is like, yeah, I'm supposed to be this like fuck you punk rocker and now I have like $50 million. It's just like, you know,
it's not stopping Metallica.
No, yeah, I know.
Hetfield's still writing songs about all the nightmares he has, and the guy has like $500 million laying around.
Yeah, well, that's proof that, you know, money, while eases a lot of shit, doesn't always fix the old noggin.
Yeah, dude, that's a really great point, actually. That's some good life advice. You if you think being like rich, if you think having $4 million is gonna solve all your problems, it's not.
No, it's not. Actually, for some people, it might even make it worse due to like accessibility and you know, heavy amounts of downtime. You know, we can go down that rabbit hole, but. What are we talking about?
we're talking about High Fidelity, but then we
oh right
got on this tangent talking about music and
Well, let me ask you, are you a Jack Black fan? I know some people are hit or miss with him.
I'm hit or miss with him too, and okay. I know a lot of people said that he like stole this movie, like that he was like the big find in it, and yeah, he had a couple really good scenes, but I think part of what made the character or his performance rather of Barry kind of realistic was that he just annoyed the shit out of me half the time. Like,
yeah,
it was kind of understandable why John Cusack put his hands on him a couple times to shut him up.
Yep.
Kind of like establishes he's the alpha of that group of marginal men, but also that it's just like, you know, he didn't know the situation, but he's just like giving him a hard time and about his sweater, and he just like goes over and he's just like, and of course he doesn't do anything, but he's just like, he grabs him. He's like, I this is vintage. I'd sock your nose. Like, no, you fucking wouldn't. Like, right. If you were going to do it, you would have done it.
And then in response to that, like, you always have to pass the buck, whether it's like the older brother beats the shit out of you, so you beat the shit out of your younger brother or whatever. I'm not saying you guys did that, Mike. I'm not saying you guys did that. But if, like, you know, Rob roughs up Barry and then Barry treats Dick like a piece of shit. And it's just like sort of like It's a little bit like the Big Lebowski dichotomy where like Walter knows he's not really the guy and like he wants the dude to be his best friend, so he just like shits on Donnie all the time.
Yeah, and like the Jack Black being kind of the intended, he was who they had in mind for this part the whole time. And like one of the things that I thought was so fascinating reading about it was that he didn't want to do it for a couple reasons. One of them was that he was actually kind of nervous that he wouldn't do a good job and that it would kind of derail his career. Like his
career. Oh, wow.
Because in his mind, he was working, he had like a two-pronged career. Like he was in Tenacious D already, and they were selling out fairly big venues, not like arenas or anything, but they were like, he could have made a living just doing that, but then he was also doing movies and television. And he was scared that if he did this movie and he didn't deliver, that it would derail all that for some reason. Like, his music fans wouldn't take him seriously. And then, you know, Hollywood people wouldn't take him seriously because he was in a $30 million production and it flopped or whatever. But it turned out to be obviously a really good move for him. But people also said that on set that he was the exact opposite how he was on screen. Like, very quiet, you know, kind of hung in the background. And then he kind of, like, just saved all that energy and that boisterousness for when he was on screen for delivering those lines. Because like I said, half the scenes he gets under my skin, but then like half the scene where he's telling off the dude from the suburbs about the Stevie Wonder album, like, that's like probably one of my favorite scenes of the movie. Just because it's like, just when he says, "Do you even know your daughter? There's no way she likes that song." Like,
and then he's like, "Babar."
Babar.
That's a good point. Like, I was just looking him up real quick. So Jack Black was probably around 30 years old when they filmed this. And before that, you know, through the 90s, very bit parts, you know, like a hacker or whatever he was in Enemy of the State.
I remember,
like,
he was in The Jackal, too. He was the guy who sold Bruce Willis the gun in that, and then he, like, blew his arm off and then shot him in pieces with it.
Yes. A small role in True Romance, which I, you know, forgot about. But mainly really small roles. And then he does this. And then right after this, he gets Shallow Hal, which like made him like a leading dude. And I wonder, you know, you definitely have more shelf life as a male actor at 30 than you do as a woman actor. But he's probably thinking like, I haven't really done shit. I'm 30. Like I gotta get myself going here or it's probably not going to work out. And then he gets this, you know, it's not this massive hit, but people see he's got chops, not just playing a very small five line part. And then all of a sudden you get Shallow Hal and then School of Rock. And then he really just takes off. And with that also Tenacious D takes off. So I would point people probably to this movie. I mean, some may disagree. Maybe there's another pick here that was a pivotal part for Jack Black's career. And time is a weird thing, and it's hard to think about this movie being 24 years old, but it's like this movie came out when you and I first hung out, pretty much. And it's crazy to think that now Jack Black's, you know, 54 and he's just well established and can probably turn things down left and right, whereas John Cusack was already established, maybe even trying to do a bit of a career resurgence around this time, late 90s or so. And then you have Jack Black, who's trying to like make a name for himself. But it's not a big cast. You know, there's not really a ton of names. We haven't talked about Tim Robbins, who was hilarious in this movie.
Yeah, dude.
But do you believe the trivia about why he took this role?
I do. Why do you enlighten everybody?
Well, that's your part. So I don't want to do that.
No, I mean, you already know it. Like, make with it.
So he took this role, and apparently it's not the first role in which he'd done this, but this is when you know you are established. So we're talking about Jack Black trying to make himself, John Cusack maybe trying to get back into relevance. Then you have Tim Robbins, who doesn't need any of it. So he takes roles post Shawshank just to get a well-made wig.
Yeah, just the...
that he can use on like Halloween. Or probably, in my opinion, some wild role-playing sex nights with Susan Sarandon.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah. By the way, I saw this. So it's talking about nepotism. I saw their son, who's obviously an actor now, Imagine being a struggling actor in LA and you're like, you're working at Applebee's and then you see like Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins' kid in like a starring movie. And you're like, you're like, son of a bitch.
Well, her daughter got that push a while ago. She didn't use,
well,
she didn't use their names. Like her name's like Ava Mori or something. She went by a different name. But...
her name did not matter, but, and she actually played the younger version of Susan Sarandon in, that Adam Sandler movie. That's My Boy, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know what I was saying, but Tim Robbins, anyway.
Tim Robbins, custom wigs. Sabre's the Anchorman.
Just taking roles just for the sake of a wig, which is just wild to me. So that's when you know you're really successful, when you'd be like, do I want to do this $30 million movie? I mean, I can use another wig.
I mean, they're not going to pay me a lot, but it's not going to take that long. But they're going to make a wig for me, and I can keep it.
And then, like, I sort of, like, fuck this chick. It's like, all right.
But it's, like, but it's really funny, and it's, like, kind of awkward. It's, like,
just... Wait, and what I do is happening in John Cusack's mind?
No okay. sex is better than the sex you're having with Ian in my head.
That's a good line, too.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's one of the moments where it's really kind of one of those relatable moments that, like, dudes go through in breakups, like when they start like ruminating on everything and they start thinking about stuff they shouldn't, that like doesn't matter anymore. That's definitely one of them. It's like,
what? I did like, that's a funny part in the movie, that the daydreams that Rob's having, what he would do if when Ian walks into the store. It's like one of them, he just goes full Attitude Era WWF on him and clangs him with the phone and knocks his teeth out. And
yeah, apparently Tim Robbins' idea, the teeth thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there was a lot of on... Like, this movie went through... You know, it was adapted from a novel, like I mentioned, and then it went through a lot of rewrites beforehand. But there is even stuff going on the set. Like, one of the things was, you know, when they show him in front of... They do this thing where... And I'm not... I didn't spot all of them for sure, but some of them were really obvious, where they always show him in some famous thing in Chicago. There's no shortage of those. And one of them is he's in front of the Biograph Theater, that he relates the story about John Dillinger getting shot there. And he said, because the you know who tipped him off? His fucking girlfriend. And that was a conversation that one of the writers had with the director. And he goes, why is that in the script? And then they just shot it and put it in the movie.
Oh, no shit. Yeah. All right. I like that. Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, bunch of cameos, some popular, some not so much. But I thought Tim Robbins was funny in the movie, and I got a kick out of Ray, aka Ian. What fucking Ian guy? The boss, Bruce Springsteen, shows up in the movie. I thought that was. I'm not a big Bruce Springsteen fan, but it's still pretty cool.
I kind of have the same policy about Bruce Springsteen that I have about like Lord of the Rings. Like, I'm not going to disrespect it, but I don't care for it.
Yeah, I don't really. I'm the same way with Lord of the Rings. I try not to step on people's toes about it, but
I'm not going to say that like Lord of the Rings are bad movies, but I didn't care for them. That doesn't,
like,
there's no accounting for taste.
Yeah, like the Clerks 2 nailed those movies, dude.
Well, I guess the Bruce Springsteen part, they wanted Bob Dylan at first, but there was like no way that was going to happen. And then
they wanted Bob Dylan, but they couldn't understand him, so they moved on to Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, you know, you just call him up, you feel better. Then they feel better, then we all feel better.
He's like, the Danish girl sound, I can understand her better than I can understand you. Lily Taylor as
Indie film
Sarah.
Darling, her and Parker Posey. They were like in all those indie films, the 90s. Yeah, that was like...
Yes. Yeah, yes. A lot of flannel.
Now, how could you leave out, she's not exactly a household name, but Joelle Carter, Ava Crowder herself. Not doing a Kentucky accent.
Yes. Good call on that one. Your favorite of mine, Sarah Gilbert from Roseanne. this one sort of flew under the radar for me. Natasha Gregson, now Natasha Gregson Wagner, the daughter of Natalie Wood.
Yeah.
I thought she was... a nice little cameo spot in this one too. We mentioned Joan Cusack, Catherine Zeta-Jones, of course, probably the biggest role out of all the exes in this movie.
Yeah, I would think so. Cause she was like, I think that was the one that was really the most painful for him. Cause it's part of it is that and this is, you know, it's going to sound how it sounds, but I think it goes for men and women. It's like, when you're punching a butt, like, I still use that in conversations. Like, you got to punch your weight when you're talking about, like, if a girl's, like, hotter than you or whatever. And it's like, I think it goes both ways. Like, if you're with somebody and they're very, very good looking, and it ends, and then you're like, I think you just take it harder. Because, like, what are the odds of that happening again?
Yeah, or when it's happening, you can't enjoy it because you're just wondering when she's gonna dump you,
and then that's how it plays out, like one way or the other.
Yeah, or it wasn't gonna play out that way, but because you've been thinking about that so much, you self sabotage and ruin the relationship.
I think that's kind of what happened to this, right? Like, they kind of spell it out in no uncertain terms. It was that, and then she gives that really shitty answer about how Marco was more glamorous than him. It's like,
oh God, awful.
And then, like, that was another thing that I thought was, you know, like, really cool about the post-relationship clarity. When you're in it, you don't realize. Like, I think part of, like, the reason he was so enamored with her was just because she was so good-looking. Like, he thought everything she said was interesting because she was good-looking and everything was funny. And then they're not together for 5 or 6 or 7 years or however much time passes. And then he just realizes, oh, she was like this the whole time and she was terrible.
Exactly, that glass-shattering moment. Yeah, agreed.
And then he didn't give a shit anymore. That it was like he knew that when he brought up the whole, like, why did we, like, the whole relationship post-mortem thing, that it was going to piss her off, but he didn't care because it was like, I don't want to be friends with her. Like,
I agree. And that, you know, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when he goes to visit her and he goes to her her party. And he meets all these pretentious assholes, these phony fucks. And it's like, I've been to that party. You know, I don't know how to explain that. But I've been in situations where, whether it's, you know, a girlfriend brings you there or someone you're dating brings you there, and you don't feel like you fit in, because I'm a pretty regular dude. I'm very candid. You know me. Like, I don't like the pretentious, stuffy, fake personalities that people like to present themselves. And, like, when you talk to somebody and all they talk to you about is the shit that they're buying, or, like, what, or they talk to you about work all the time, and you're just like, oh my God, the last thing I want to do is hear about your job, let alone think about mine. So he shows up there, and I feel like he's me. Like, he's like, he's looking around, and he's just like, it's like a kid showing up to school and not having friends. He's like, I don't belong here. And it's like what you were saying. Like, he was sort of like, I can't fucking believe I'm here. I can't fucking believe I dated this person. And I just loved everything about that scene, because for me, it was just so relatable. And I imagine for a lot of people who aren't of the, you know, materialistic, you know, superficial work and money is everything group, probably feels the same way.
Yeah, it's not even just like about socioeconomic differences or like whatever, but one of the things in this movie that really kind of stuck with me, and I didn't realize how much it did, is when he says the thing about how what you like, not what you are like, matters. And
yeah,
like, if you know, your friends are people that people have often said it kind of belongs on a Hallmark card, is a little hackneyed, but like, your friends are your family that you choose. So it's like, would you choose people that you have nothing in common with, or is it people that like the same movies, that like the same music generally? Like, you can just shoot the shit about random stuff that it's like common ground, as opposed to, you know, if you go to some event that, you know, this is all hypothetical, but like, I'm sure most men and, you know, two women will listen to this, but like, most of the men listening have been,
and we thank you
indeed, because it's not always easy. But you know, like, you get dragged to something, you know, it's like, you want to keep your girlfriend happy, so you go to some thing with her, and it's all her friends and their boyfriends, we're all guys you don't know, and you're trying to, like, make conversation about stuff, and they're like, so do you golf? And you're like, no, man, I don't golf. And they're like, oh. And then they proceed to talk about golf for 10 fucking minutes, and you just think about, like, how comforting it would be to just bury a fucking shrimp skewer up to your brain, like, through your ear canal, because you just can't listen to this fucking guy talk about golf because he didn't pick up on the social cue that you don't give a fuck about golf, but he proceeds to talk about it at length anyway.
You know what the move is now, like, in retrospect, is say you love golf and then out golf him as hard as possible, but obviously say things that show that you know nothing about golf.
Yeah, you're talking like Carl Spackler and Caddyshack. Like it's like yeah, it was about 450 yards, so I used a 9 iron, and
like yeah, so I pull up to the first tee, and
come everywhere.
No, there's people watching. It's like 410 yards to the pin, 10 miles per hour wind in my face. I take out the 3 wood. I golfed it so hard. I still, to this day, you know, I, whether it's, you know, people through, you know, Kathleen knows, you know, I told this person we would hang out. We got to go hang out. I'm like, and it's like a Saturday and like how precious weekends are. You're just like, we got, you know, whether it's, we have a sitter or something, but you know, you go to these situations and you're like, my God, I can't wait to tell my friends about this, how awful this is. And that makes you appreciate your real friends more, I guess, which is what, you know, I guess Rob ends up having in these guys who work for him in the record store, because we don't really like Rob doesn't really have friends. That's another part of this movie that, you know, they didn't really reveal to us, is that it's either he puts everything into his relationships and then that becomes his social existence, or it's these two schmucks who work for him at the record store.
Yeah, that's like some good subtext I didn't pick up on, was the fact that it's like you're not going to get a fully developed, it's really hard to develop a character completely in an hour, 45-minute movie. But, yeah, I mean, they don't, like, they're the closest thing he has to friends, and they're kind of not. They're like-minded people who work for him. He's the boss.
Yeah, like Dick is a very one-dimensional guy, and, like, you're not going to sit down. It's like that scene where Dick goes to his apartment and gets so blown away, and Rob is so, like, feels like he's so, like, he's impressing him so much by telling him he's autobiographically organizing his record collection. And Dick's like, no fucking way. And it's just, and it's like, that's all that guy is. So it's like, if you eliminate music and try to talk to Dick, you talk about nothing. Dick. That's probably why his name is Dick. He doesn't talk about Dick. He doesn't know shit about Dick. So he doesn't know Dick about anything. But then, you know, Barry is just like so annoying to fucking deal with. And it's like, but these are his, like, these are his friends. And maybe it's just like they wanted to simplify the movie. And I don't know how much, like you said, it aligns with the book. And maybe that's why they wanted to do it. But, you know, for the sake of time and the story, they know that they have to go through these 5 breakups. So that's part of the story. That's a big chunk there. The new lover, that's a chunk of the story, the Tim Robbins thing. And then, of course, they got to sell us on this relationship between Laura and him. There's no time, you know, for friends. Maybe they could have snuck in another friend in there somewhere, like a Jeremy Piven type of thing, like in Serendipity. But in this movie, they didn't do it. So he's left with these two guys to try to show us not like how good of a friend Rob is or anything, but sort of what annoys him. So that you're like, oh, I sort of get another layer to this guy beyond his relationships. And maybe that's enough. Like, you see them at the bar and the three of them are nerding out about Lisa Bonet. And you're like, oh, I kind of get this. These guys, because you have friends, I'm sure, that I don't even know, that you have one thing you bond with them over. And it's like, that's him with these two guys, with music. You're like, you have a knit, like maybe you know someone who likes the Chiefs. I have no idea. But like, there are certain friends you have in your life where it's like, I know our lane. This is pretty much it. This is pretty much all we're going to talk about. Like me with like some people with Star Wars. Like I have people I talk to about Star Wars beyond my podcast co-hosts. And it's like, I know once I'm done talking about Star Wars, we're not going to talk about, you know, anything else. So that's just how Rob's relationship is with Barry and Dick.
I did kind of like the face turn Barry takes at the end, though, where Rob's all anxious about his band playing because he thinks they're going to suck. And like
Sonic Death Monkey.
Yeah, it's going to drive people away. And then it turns out that I don't think it was a coincidence that he was singing that song that he mentioned in his top 5 list during that first conversation, that first scene we see them all in together. And he also cites later as an important song in his relationship with Laura. Like, do you think that was a coincidence that he's singing "Let's Get It On" at the end? I don't think it was. I think it was he was
That's
listening
a great
to
point.
Him. And
that's a great point, man.
Maybe at some other juncture he realized that was an important song to him, at least. Maybe not to their relationship, but he knew it was important to him. So he kind of sung the song at every, like, that was a kind of a cool scene too, how everybody was so surprised that he was like a good, like a decent singer. Like, because no one saw it coming.
That's a great point, man. And it's all, yeah. Well done. Bravo. I like that. And then it's almost like, I don't know that Rob had a lot of options, but he's like, all right, you can play. And it's like Barry, like, seeing if he trusts him or not. Because he could have told him, hey, dude, we're going to do Let's Get It On. It's going to be awesome. People are going to love it. But he's like, it's either he wants to get a rise out of Rob and see how annoyed he can get him, or he's like, I want to see if this dude will trust me, and then I'm going to show him the payoff.
Yeah, what do you think it is? Because, I mean, that's definitely not something they spell out in the movie.
Knowing Barry, you got to feel like he likes getting a rise out of people, because, like, throughout the movie, like, with that guy with the record, he refused to sell it to him. Like, he likes this. He likes to push people's buttons. So I think he just, like, wanted to surprise people, but he wanted it to be a this big, like, reveal thing, because he likes the theatrical element of it. So my guess is he was just trying to push Rob's buttons and try to irritate him, and then, of course, show that everything's going to be okay. What do you think?
I mean, there's also the possibility, and this just occurred to me now, that, like, he just formed that band and they had no idea what their identity was. So that was, like, something they were batting around. I thought you guys were Sonic Death Monkeys. Like, no, that was Thursday. Like, we're past that now.
Yeah. And it is funny that they mentioned he had that ad up in the store for 3 years or whatever it was. And he's like, no one's ever come in to ask you. And then this guy comes in and you act all casual about it. He's probably, like, so excited that people wanted to play with him that he wanted to make sure he did a good job, too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That could definitely factor into it as well. I guess the last part we did not talk about the Marie LaSalle part at all. I guess that was another part that was pretty difficult to cast, because in the book, all the characters are British except Marie LaSalle. She's a touring musician from the U.S. So right. they wanted to cast somebody who was musically inclined, but also kind of seemed like kind of outside of Rob's normal, even though he has a Danish girlfriend, which kind of, like, throws a wrench in that whole thing, but, like, throws it, like, a hit in his more. and then he also dated Catherine Zeta-Jones, who's Welsh, but looks like she's Spanish. Like, so I don't know, but
yeah,
I'm really not helping this case at all. But I guess one of the people they talked to for the part was Liz Phair, who I don't know if you're familiar with her at all, but she's actually from New Haven originally. But
is she really?
Yeah, but she came up in the Chicago scene, and there's, like, a lot of these, like I mentioned, I'm not going to get into all of them because I don't remember them off the top of my head, and even if I did, it would be me. It'd probably sound like it'd be like clicking noises for most people, but there's a lot of references to the Chicago music scene and indie music scene, all that stuff. But she was supposed to play that part, and I guess they decided to go with Lisa Bonet at the last minute, and she's kind of like a catalyst, one of the catalysts to help Rob get back to Laura, because it's kind of like, I mean, that's how I, like, at least from a narrative perspective, but it's like, it was like, I thought it was cool how they hit it off really well. And he was talking about how, I think that's what segues into that scene where he says, what you like matters, not what you are like. Cause he said, and by that measure, I was having one of the best dates of my life, and they hit it off really well. Then they have a one night stand, and he's like, yeah, I'll call you. And she's like, yeah, sure you will. Cause she knew, like, he wasn't past it. And she was
right.
And, credit to the actress and the writing and all that stuff. But she seemed like bohemian enough that didn't really bother her. It's like, yeah, it's cool. Whatever. Like, it was fun. I think she even says, I'm not going to let it get in the way of a fuck or whatever. It's like, oh,
yes.
It's a little.
Yeah. She says she says something along the lines of, I guess when they were still at, was it his apartment or her apartment? But she says, yeah, something about it's all about the fuck or whatever. Yeah. I agree. She was just sort of like, they both knew what was going on, and that was okay. And maybe that was his, yeah, like you say, his way of sort of rebounding or trying to get over the heartbreak. And then Laura had her version too, which,
Which I seemed a lot more, it just didn't seem as organic. It seemed more forced. Like, it was just, it was some dude that she's known for a long time. And with Rob, it was like he happened to stumble across a musician who was into a lot of the same things. And
right. And then at the end, I want to get your take on this, because to me, it's obvious. But the Natasha Gregson-Wagner, the Caroline Fortis character, who, you know, is a music journalist or whatever, and she's talking about very flirty with him in the shop. Like, I was like, is she like a plant to see if Rob has changed? Because it seemed like this gorgeous girl walks in and she's just like all flirty with him. And then she's at the club and like you could see like Rob easily taking that bait. But or is it just a simple device of the movie showing us like Rob has changed and he has learned? Because at one point I was like, is this like Joan Cusack's character's coworker? And she's like throwing her in there to see if Rob is still a scumbag or not. And like it just sort of fizzled out at the end. What do you think?
Oh, no. I mean, I think it was just a Hollywood conceit. Like she was representative of like the last hurdle he needed to cross to really.
That's right. Commit. Yeah. OK.
Yeah. Because yeah, I figured. My understanding of Joe Cusack's character, because they don't really spell it out, is she's more Laura's friend than his, but yeah. They become friends over right. the time that they're dating. But like right. she's, I think, because you see the way she's dressed, like she has like an office job. Maybe she's a lawyer too, or a paralegal or whatever. And then the Caroline Fortis character wrote a column that he liked in a music magazine yep. or in a newspaper or something.
Yep.
So they're from two different walks of life. That's interesting. You went like conspiratorial with it. Like it was a loyalty test that she was setting
up. I know, but it's just like with a movie like this, which, you know, seems very grounded, to just toss in this extremely attractive person at the end who just happens to really like this guy and know about him and all that. I was like, this is like, I would be like, all right. Kathleen, come on out. Come on out. Like, but, you know.
Oh, you're not going to get me.
You're not going to. And then she's like, what the fuck are you talking about, dude? I just want to blow you. And you're like, oh, sorry, I can't. I love this Danish girl whose name is Emine Djulgar. Eben Yale, which I gun to my head for playing the game Bomb. Not naming another movie she's in.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was always curious, because it's not like this movie was like a runaway hit or anything, but it didn't flop. It was, and it got some good, it had some good critical buzz around it. And then especially it went on later to, it was, I think they adapted it into a Broadway musical. And then they did completely forgot about it until I read about it, but they did like a gender swap TV version of it with Zoe Kravitz, which is, I guess that's kind of like a sly backhanded like reference to the original movie, because she's Lisa Bonet's daughter. But right. I didn't like that. I remembered that they did that, and I was just like, ugh. And that apparently people agreed, because it was only on for one season. It was canceled.
Yeah, when I heard that they were making that, I said, I want to get away.
yeah.
American Woman. Lenny Kravitz, man. All right, so overall, I didn't really talk to you about this. Did you have a favorite part in the movie? And how long had it been since you had seen it?
Oh, it'd been a while. Like, I mean, I got my quota of this movie between, you know, 2001 and 2005. I probably watched this movie like 50 or 60 times.
I think we're on the same sort of path.
I kind of wish I'd seen it in the theater, this and Gross Point Blank. Because, like, I think these two movies are like a big part of the reason why I think I like John Cusack a lot more than I do. Like, cause I like them so much. Like they're both like, they're kind of difficult to classify. They're comedies, but they're not. And there's real stuff in there. But no, I mentioned like one of my favorite parts is Barry telling the guy off of the record store, just cause it's funny. Like the interjection of fantasy elements to really kind of portray Rob's like psychological stress that he's going through with his breakup is like that all works together. But I don't know if I like there's really like a standout scene or anything. Like I there's just like lots of little things in this movie that I think I've kind of integrated into, I guess, what you would call a personal philosophy you know, like, but there's, I didn't realize, like, when I was revisiting it this time, like, I didn't realize how many references we've made to it or I've made to it over the years in casual conversations with people. But,
it's always, it's always like, I don't know, it's so satisfying when that pops up in a movie and you subconsciously, like, it's subconscious and you realize it and you're like, oh my God, that's where I got that from. Or, because there are plenty of things that I will, you know, drop from a movie in everyday conversation too. And I don't say, like, by the way, that's from, you know, Christmas Vacation. That's why I call people egg timers when they're slow on the highway. But I just do that. And I know you do that too. And it's just like, it's our own entertainment.
I'll tell you what, though. Like, you were pretty critical of Il Halle's performance. But... one of the scenes that I really liked with her that I think kind of conveyed their relationship in better times and her charm was when he comes home and she's unexpectedly there and she's reading his top five list that he left laying around. And she's like going over it with him and she actually kind of, she ribs him a little bit, but then she reassures him that you'd probably rather be doing what you're doing now than almost anything on this list. And like, I think that scene kind of goes a long way to kind of show the rapport they had at one point or how deep their relationship might have been.
Yeah.
Because I kind of cut myself off, which I tend to do at least once per discussion, but you mentioned that you didn't know anything else she was in. And one of the things I stumbled across when I was doing my cursory research for this thing was that by her description, and who knows if maybe if this movie made like $200 million, like you said, or it was more, maybe it would have been different, but right after this movie wrapped, she had just had a kid like a few months before production started. So she had this little baby, and for whatever reason, I shouldn't say for whatever reason, it makes it sound like, well, her decision was she just didn't want to move to America and have a career here. So she just stayed in Denmark and she did films.
Yeah.
Nothing I'm familiar with, but I don't know if they were all in Denmark, but I'm sure they were in Denmark or maybe continental Europe. But she just kind of made this decision that she wanted to raise her son in Denmark. And I don't know. She said maybe if she had been a little more ambitious or pursued it more, she could have had a career in Hollywood, but it didn't seem like, and again, like that could just be her spin on it. But it sounds like if you kind of go off of her being in this, and then kind of what happened after that, it fits somewhat.
Yeah. And look, who the hell am I? I mean, she's been in successful movies. You know, it's like that's a big achievement. So I'm just saying maybe in fairness to her, they didn't spend enough time with relationship Rob and Laura. I probably would have rooted for the reunion more if we saw more of them together during, like, when they were in the pocket. And, like, they showed us flashes, but it was just so quick. If they showed us maybe even just one more scene, like, you know, like, we did Tarantino recently, how, like, in the middle of the movie, he'll just hit you with it. It's like, he'll slow everything down and give you this long scene between two characters. Like, if they gave us, like, a 6-minute conversation or something between the two of them eating ice cream cones and talking about something, just something a little more between Rob and Laura when they were together, it would have been enough. I for some reason, as I'm thinking about the movie and running it through my head, I'm like, I really am not remembering a ton of Rob and Laura good times for me to want them to get back to it.
Yeah. Cause I don't think that was the focus of it. The focus was the breakup and then the kind of explanation of the factors that went into it. And then when they get back to, it's not like a storybook romance, how they get back together. They're, she even says like they're talking and she's just like, I'm just tired. And he's like, I'm tired too. And like, I think that's not just in their dynamic, but also just kind of externally. Like I've heard that before. Like the whole, like, I'm tired of this. Like I'm tired of, you know, trying to find something. I don't know, but, I think that kind of stuff does happen, though. Like, the whole thing about her father dying, they threw that in, and it was like they had like a casual reference to it at the beginning that he had a kind of a long-standing health thing. And then, I mean, that stuff like that, that's not out of it's not like some completely fantastic thing for that to happen. I mean, when deaths and families happen, I mean, that shakes things up quite a bit. And either people, there's no telling what could happen. It's like people could either get out of the relationships they're in, or they could go back to something that's safe and familiar to them.
Yeah, good point. Fair point. I mean, maybe a flashback or two. It also would have been funny just from this, for the sake of, you know, not always having the happy ending, like you say. Which I like that the breakup actually did that, where they're like, they didn't get back together. But maybe. It would be funny if, like, at the end of this, you know, you got Barry doing the Let's Get It On, and they're, you know, dancing together, and they're happy, and they're together, and he rejects the new girl and to show us that he's changed. If they did one of those things where they do, like, 6 months later, Rob and Laura broke up.
Just,
and that's how the movie ends.
I don't know, man. I think I kind of like the upbeat ending a little bit, because
I do too.
The movie gives you enough realism throughout.
Yeah,
little griminess, little shadiness.
Oh, for sure. It's a really good movie, and I mean, there's a reason we're talking about it. It's not because it made $500 million. It's because it's a really solid flick, and it was a good pick on your behalf. So I hope for people, because I don't think it's. Even for people who like John Cusack, I don't know if it's one of those movies. Well, maybe for people like John Cusack, but I don't think it's one of those movies that people always have on the tip of their tongue or the front of their minds, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, I don't even think for all the stuff we've been talking about, I don't really think we've talked about John Cusack's performance all that much. And we have it in little bits, like, you know, how he... You know, the manic stuff that he does that's, like, kind of funny. Like, it's not Keaton level, but it's good. It's real good. But I think this is one of those parts that when they optioned this originally, like, the studio had it for years, and then they thought of him to adapt it into a movie because the studio had worked with him on Gross Point Blank, and they even used the same music supervisor. So if you like the musical choices of this movie... that's her doing. Her name escapes me at the moment. But I think a lot of actors would not have been right for this part. Like, can you imagine, like, if somebody you mentioned, like, if Matthew McConaughey was in this, and he's, like, all, like, trying to be all contemplative and wax, and, like, waxing nostalgic. It's like he already would have been on to the next thing. He would have been at the bar and then been like, oh. I seem to have taken my shirt off. And then, like, all of a sudden he's just surrounded by women. Like, he goes to, like, fucking Senior Frogs or whatever, just topless. And then he just, like, leaves with two women, like, the same night they break up. It's not the same thing. And I'm not, like, because even, like, and I'm not saying that John Cusack was any slouch, especially in the late 90s, early 2000s, but he's not McConaughey. Like, right. Even exactly. The Danish chick said he was, she said she thought he was really good looking. When she got cast, so, but yeah, I think he was more vulnerable than a lot of other actors would have been, like, going through this whole. I know you said you didn't like the whole fourth wall thing that he did, but I think that was probably the best way. First of all, it was kind of an homage to Alfie, that movie with Michael Caine that was made in the 60s that was later.
I haven't seen it, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, there was a remake with Jude Law in it. I would suggest the original, but. It was also to kind of, like, because everybody involved liked the source material so much, they felt that was the only way to really convey some of the prose and the character's thoughts and state, because they'd already changed so much, but everybody, like, I guess the author and most of the people involved were pretty happy with how faithful it stayed to the book, even with the large changes they made.
It's just a shame, you know, that Connie Nielsen was doing Gladiator probably around the same time. Because talk about a Danish. If she's Laura in this, I mean, come on.
So what is it? So is it with Laura? Is it a personality thing, or you think she's just not hot enough?
No, that's so. I'm not gonna trap myself like that. I'm not that stupid. But I don't know. I don't know if it's. I think it was the personality. I'm not a big fan of bangs either.
It was the bangs then.
Maybe
just say it was the bags.
All right, it was the bags. We like to have fun around here.
So you think Connie Nielsen would have been such a rapid departure? Like, first of all, aren't her and John Cusack like the same height? Like, Connie Nielsen's a tall drink of water, isn't she? She's like 5'11 or something.
Didn't stop her from Lars Ulrich, though.
When did they get together?
They have a kid together.
Oh, they did. Yeah, but then she stole Matt Damon. He stole Matt Damon's girl, didn't he?
Before that.
Oh, before that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. See, yeah. I'm not as up on Lars Ulrich's love life as I should be, I guess.
Yeah, and then Matt Damon, you know, based the whole character in Good Will Hunting off of her, Skyler.
Yeah.
Which was almost going to be my next pick, but it's not.
Okay. All right. Well, but before you get to the next pick, I mean, I know this is like, I didn't think this was going to be one of our longer ones, but we covered everything. Not everything, but I just want to know if there's any loose ends, anything that we didn't really get to. Like, I didn't ask you what your favorite scene is because I didn't even really answer you. I kind of answered at the beginning, but not really.
Yeah, I said it was the scene where he goes to Charlie's party because he goes through that realization of just hating fake people. And I've always felt that way, and the older I get, the more I feel that way. So it's just very, the connectivity on that scene for me now versus when I first saw it when I was 19 is just exponentially higher. So probably that scene. I know it's not one of those like, oh my God, that scene is just incredible, but I don't know. I just related to it really well. And it reminded me of a lot of experiences that I've had like that. So probably that scene where he visits Charlie again and sees that she hasn't really changed at all. She's just an older version of herself with probably a little more money. So I think that one. And then of course, cherry on the sundae is, you know, him screaming at her when they break up. Calling her bitch. I think that one. But I mean, there's a lot of great scenes. I'm a John Cusack fan. Like, I think the reason why I gave Hot Tub Time Machine a chance is because of John Cusack, and I actually think that's a severely underrated comedy. That's like a really funny movie that I just watched recently with Kathleen. I was laughing my ass off at that movie. So I've always liked John Cusack, you know. So it's you're gonna be hard pressed for me to not, you know, praise his performances, especially in a movie like this, which, talk about top fives, it's definitely in his top five, if not his number one.
I would say this is in my top five romantic comedies, but that's like not really say. I guess that's not saying a whole lot, but because I don't really.
Is it? But is it? Is it? Is it your top five? What's Laura's name?
Eben Hochlock.
Yeah. Is it your top five Eben Djilkis movies?
We're so like, I'm such a dumbass. Like, dude, I mean, like you told me how to say the name. We didn't have to be doing this bit right now. And I just couldn't fucking help myself.
I texted you before we start and you're like, I'm just going to call her the Danish girl for the whole movie, the whole podcast. Yeah. So out of respect to her, Eben Yale.
Good on you, man, for edifying us.
Yes. Yeah.
Those Nordic languages—they are.
But a really good movie, and I did enjoy talking about it. I feel like I don't know that there's anything else I could bring up without feeling like I'm talking in circles. But.
Well, we didn't really bring up the whole, like, we didn't touch on every single breakup because, well, the one was with a teenager, so that's, you know, there's no touching, like, that's better left alone, but. We didn't really talk about the Lily Taylor one, which was like, it was like a textbook, like, sad bastard rebound thing. And that was like, that was what drew him together. And then when he got back, when he like reunited with her, it was like this, it was just the same thing. It was like she hadn't moved forward at all, which was kind of sad if you think about
it. That's true, because they both went through a breakup, so they used each other to get over their shit. And then she goes, I met someone else. And she just leaves him high and dry. And she's like, oh, too bad. Sorry, dude. And then when he reconnects with her just to see how she's doing, she's clinging back onto him and unloads all her fucking shit on him about the medication she's taking and whether it's working or not. And he's probably like, oh, shit.
Yeah, then she's like, I lost my job, so it's been hand-to-mouth. It's like, I'm not big on pop psychology terms, but when you want to talk about, like, a fucking emotional vampire, like, you imagine, like, if you ran into somebody you hadn't seen in, like, 4 or 5 years, whatever the nature of your relationship was, and they're just like letting you have it with both barrels. It's like, man. Yeah, and then the biopsy was positive, so I have to kind of weigh my options with that. And you're like, holy fuck. Like, we just went to high school together. Like, I didn't want to get into all this shit.
I know. You're like, so Raisin Bran, huh? All right. Shit.
Yeah, it's like,
I
go ahead.
I would do it, like, depending on who it is, like, I'm definitely guilty of doing that thing where if you see somebody you know but you haven't talked to them in forever and you know it would be nothing but small talk and maybe the occasional memory, I try to avoid. I try to pretend I didn't see them or something.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that too. And then, like, sometimes I run into that person later and they're like, oh, I haven't seen you in forever. And it's like, no, I saw you a year ago. You just didn't know. You didn't see me.
Like, or you do the thing where they're like, I saw you at the grocery store, but it looks like you were on your way out. And you're like, oh, you did? When? And you're like, I know exactly when this happened.
And then you're trying, like, the other thing is, like, when you do the whole, like, you bit off more than you could chew, and then you just, they're just talking, and you just go, just the audible sigh, just like, yeah, I fucked up here.
Or if things aren't going well for them or going too well for them, you have to try to match the energy so that they either don't feel bad or you feel like you're at their level. It's exhausting. Now I understand why people don't leave their homes. Yeah,
especially now, as you said, as you mentioned, and I agree that people's social skills collectively are just in the toilet right now.
It is bad. It is really bad.
It's fucking not great.
No, it isn't. And I that's one thing I'm good at. And I'm genuine when I'm socializing with people. And I have a pretty good read on people, too. And it's just, man. That's why sometimes when Kathleen's like, oh, we got to go to, you know, I told this person from I used to work with that we'd, you know, catch up with them. And we got to meet her kids and her husband and stuff. I'm like, do they talk, like, what's this guy like? Give me someone we can compare him to that I've talked to. Is he going to ask me about work all the time? Like, I need to prepare myself for how bad people are at socializing. But anyway, no one needs to hear about that. Mike, anything else on High Fidelity? I feel like we covered most of it, but I don't want to oversaturate. But
yeah, I'm kind of on the same boat. Like, conversation is a little more meandering than usual, but I think we, you know, talked about the major themes and some interesting stuff, like comparisons, and then, you know, some of the, like I said, not a lot of great trivia with this one, not a lot of casting drama, whatever.
If we lived close to each other, we could have done this podcast in a record store while looking at records, but
yeah, how much fun would that have been?
I think it would have been pretty
cool. I'm just like peeping all the Lana Del Rey vinyl. I'm like, uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Do you guys have on vinyl the single of When Two Become One by any chance?
Guy looks at you like you're just fucking dumb. He's like,
for what? Your daughter? Like, trying to introduce her to Spice Girls? He's like, no, it's for me.
What, do you have a niece or something? I mean, yeah, I do, but that's not who it's for.
Oh, do you have kids at home? No, I live by myself. So do you have it? Also, where's your candle section?
All right. Are we done with
this?
All
right. All right. God almighty. Shut the fuck up. Me. No, all right. All right, so I got to pick one, right?
Yeah, so where are we going next? What's
Well, we're going to a similar... Now, High Fidelity was 2000, right?
I think so. It was 99 or 2000. I wanted to say it at the top, but I wasn't sure about the year, and I'm always wrong when I guess.
Yeah, it was 2000. It came out March of 2000. So we're going to dial it back a year. And we're going to go with a movie that, in my opinion, is a classic comedy that put a few faces on the map that are still around today. And we are going to talk about the original American Pie.
Oh, man. Okay. It makes sense. Makes sense. I was wondering where we were going to get to this one.
Yeah. Now, a franchise now, not going to touch like all the straight-to-video spinoffs or whatever, but that has four pretty bankable movies. But the original came out about kids in high school around our age when it came out. So I have very fond memories about this movie, and I look forward to revisiting it because it's certainly a movie that probably couldn't be made the same way it was then today, and we'll probably talk about that. But what do you think, American Pie?
All right, let's do it.
All right, Mike. Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on getting your car back. I know you're very happy about that.
Yeah, sorry about your car troubles, too. We didn't really discuss that, but...
Yeah, did all my shit happen since our last episode?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get T-boned in my car by some idiot that's not wearing pants who ran a stop sign. And they totaled my car, and I got another certified pre-owned. And I'm back on the horse. But with all that, it's been a little while. So I want to thank everybody who's been listening to us as we enter our fourth year of the podcast. Is that right?
Yeah.
Holy hell.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you to everybody, whether you're new or you check in depending on the movie or you listen every time. However, thanks for listening to Just Like the Movies. We appreciate it very much. So make sure you do subscribe to the show. If it has a rating system, toss some 5 stars up there for us and tell a friend. Hopefully over the holidays, you told some people about us and you go along the ride with us on the tips of nostalgia and sometimes recent movies that me and Mike love to talk about, love to watch, and love to joke about. But until next time, from me and Mike here at Just Like the Movies, we hope you all be kind, rewind, relax, and see you later.
They're about girls, right?
Just kidding.
Bear.